Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I'm joined by Chad Montry, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and author of four books, including a brand new one, The Myth of Silent Spring, Rethinking the Origins of American Environmentalism. It was published a few weeks ago by the University of California Press. Chad Montry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
Chad, you've been unquestionably one of the scholars at the forefront of bringing social history and labor history into the study of the history of environmental thought and environmental politics in the United States. So I hoped we could begin with you maybe historicizing yourself a bit, and I'd love to learn what led you to pursue a career as an academic historian and how you came to the research interests and, can I say, moral commitments that are really on display in all of your work?
Yeah, sure. I think though probably that background before I realized I wanted to become an historian probably explains a lot about the kind of work that I did do.
Sure.
By the time I was a teenager, I was doing a lot of social activism and mostly interested in that as much as school. And at that point, the anti-apartheid movement was still going on. So that was the thing that kind of drew me in first. And I got sort of immersed in that locally in Louisville, where I was growing up. And from there, I met people that are part of the Socialist Workers Party. And so I joined the SWP, or actually within the youth part of that, the YSA, the Youth Socialist Alliance. And that really sort of gave me, I think, sort of a foundation for how to understand different social problems in the United States, but also with an international perspective, which is something that the SWP is sort of known for. And I'm not, you know, I didn't stay in the SWP very long, but it really, I think, kind of framed sort of a lot of my own thinking, and it's still sort of with sort of, you know, in part of my perspective today. I went to college around the same time, and I ended up at the University of Louisville, and I studied with John Kumbler, who's probably somebody other people might be reading my book would be familiar with his work too. He at the time was teaching both a labor history course and an environmental history course, and I took both of those and had sort of the idea, you know, that he was somebody that encouraged this idea that, you know, that there may be like common ground between the two fields, that you could sort of think of a hybrid version of that. But in the 1990s, that was, you know, not really apparent in terms of the literature. I think probably one of the few people that had sort of advanced that notion was Andrew Hurley with his book, Environmental Inequalities. But other than that, you know, we were still reading sort of the common classics, you know, L.L. Leopold and Silent Spring. But he sort of opened the door, John opened the door for this, I think, and then eventually in his own work with his book Reasonable Use, he did do something like a blend of social history and environmental history. The thing that I liked about John that really attracted to me, you know, is attracting me to him as a student was that he was one of the founding members of Students for a Democratic Society there at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when he was a college student. And he also had been part of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and went down to Mississippi. And so he was part of that generation of social activists who then themselves gravitated into history, and they sort of pioneered the new labor and new social history. And that's a part of also, I think, the explanation for why his work ended up being that way. Like, he was an environmental historian who could understand that we needed to have this sort of hybrid and not just sort of a standard environmental history that was coming out of, I think, some of the first wave of literature after the field was, you know, sort of officially founded in the 1970s and 1980s. So John was a great person to work with for somebody like me who wanted not to sort of be constrained or delimited by what the literature seems to suggest with what the field was about. And so then he also was a model for me in terms of like, well, what did I want to do, you know, for a career? And, you know, I really admired his personal commitments in terms of his social activism. I liked his work as a professional historian. And I thought, well, that's something that I'd like to do myself. And I loved being in college and under college environment. And so just sort of like an excuse to stay there forever, right, is to become a professor. And, so then I decided to go to graduate school, and I went to work with Warren Van Tine at the Ohio State University. He is known for his biography of John Lewis, who's the leader of the United Mine Workers for a good part of the 20th century. And I figured that would be a good way to sort of I have a base in labor history, but also I had plans that I'd sort of venture beyond labor history while I was there, trying to figure out different topics, you know, with seminar papers, but then also in my master's thesis and my dissertation. So I actually finished a master's thesis about urban environmental reform in Chicago. And that summer of 1997, I decided I'd just take a break and go do some good work for a union, the United Food and Commercial Workers, which had a labor internship open. And they sent me down to Eastern Kentucky. So I was born in Toledo, Ohio, but I grew up in Kentucky. So I'm sort of familiar with the different social activism and labor unions in that are based in Louisville. And I had contacts with them. I'd actually worked with them before doing some labor organizing. So I got sent down to Eastern Kentucky, and there was a grocery store worker strike that we were working on. And we went over to this place called Apple Shop, which is a sort of a nonprofit media center that is sort of kind of had its origins in the anti-poverty movement of the 1960s. A lot of people that sort of stuck around in Appalachia, and they established Apple Shop. We went over there to talk to them on the radio. They had a radio station to help promote the strike. And after we were done on the radio gig, then I was discussing with them that I needed a dissertation topic, that I wanted to do something about labor and environmental history, or, you know, blending the social dimensions of, you know, people's lives with their experience and relationship with nature, how environmental problems, you know, are part of that, and how they engage in environmental activism, but with the social dimension sort of apparent. And and they almost immediately, I mean, it was like without, you know, hesitation, they said, well, what about the movement against strip mining here in Appalachia? And I had never really heard much about that. And it wasn't in the literature that I read in college or in graduate school. And even growing up in Louisville, it was something, you know, nobody had really talked about, that people just sort of had forgotten, which is interesting now that I actually, you know, sort of paced my way through the archives and wrote a book about it. Like, that it was such an important movement, and actually it was well known at the time that it did get forgotten, that, you know, that this was something that sort of got buried. But that was a great topic to test out this idea of having, you know, an environmental history that was informed by the social history of the region, and there's a labor history element to it too, because the mine workers themselves were a part of the opposition to strip mining, and so it gave me a chance to do something very particular, right? Like, it was one particular campaign, one particular issue, and that was my first book, To Save the Land and People. And then from there, I kind of gradually got more general. The next book was Making a Living, and then the one after that was People's History of Environmentalism in the United States. And then so this one that I just got done with, The Myth of Silent Spring, is sort of like building on my own research and also the work of a lot of other really great historians over the last 15 or 20 years or so, that now enables us to tell like a new revisionist version of the origins of environmentalism. And I mean, we'll get to this later, I guess, when we talk about what I'm going to be doing next. But I think this is my last book on environmental history, because I feel like it kind of said what I have to say. And I think now it's kind of, you know, there's a lot of really other great, rich work that's going on out there. My work is sort of like traveled an arc that I sort of like feel satisfied with, from that very, like I said, very particular book, To Save the Land and People, to this very general comment on, you know, how we might rethink the origins of environmentalism. So the book itself, though, is something that I had not planned to write, The Myth of Silent Spring, but I went to the association, the Environmental History Conference in 2015 in DC, and Kate Marshall from the University of California Press asked me if I wanted to meet with her and talk about, you know, what I was up to. And then she suggested that I write another book, which, I don't know, that was just not what I was like. I was already working on another one that was not environmental history, which is what I'm now back to doing after having finished The Myth of Silent Spring. And she pitched it in a way that I sort of thought about it more. And I was actually on a panel to talk about how, you know, we need to rethink the origins of environmentalism. And that's why I was there at the conference. And I got home, I sort of continued to talk to Kate about it. And so I ended up deciding to write the book. But I had sort of an idea of how I'd approach it, which is not sort of the way that the book turned out. But in many respects, the idea of sort of centering it around, organizing it around aspects of Silent Spring and thinking about the book Silent Spring came from a lot of the help and comments that I got from Catherine Morse and David Stradling, who I like also, and their work is really good and part of, I think, that foundational literature that's allowing us to do this revisionist new narrative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So from there, that's how we did it.
Thanks for taking us through that arc. I really appreciate that. I think the book, mm-hmm. I mean, the Myth of Silent Spring, really important and useful and accessible also. And it also, it must be said, has the most eye-catching title I've seen in a long time. So Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, these are for the most part, you know, beyond reproach in environmental circles. And I think just this month, I think it was, that the Library of America is publishing Silent Spring in a collection of Carson's writings, which is an event that some might see as her apotheosis into the canon of American literature. Well, we should probably be clear from the start that your book is not a hit job on Carson or an attempt to expose Silent Spring as, you know, full of myths or bad science or anything. You're not in the employ of the chemical industry.
Right. It's a very important point, and it's something that I allude to in the acknowledgments. And when I talk about the book, I always make sure to begin with this, when Silent Spring came out, actually when it was first serialized in New York, or even before the book itself was published, the chemical industry did go after her, and a lot of the way that they pitched her criticism was to say that, you know, women couldn't do science, that she was probably a communist, that she might be a lesbian. And my book is in no way part of that. Since that time, there's been a sort of an ongoing attempt to critique the book, saying that by pointing out the problems with the use of DDT, that subjects, you know, people to, you know, death around the world who need DDT to control malaria or other diseases. And I'm not also trying to contribute to that literature either. And in fact, I'm really not. The book itself, I think, has a lot of merits even today. It stands up well for what it was meant to do, which is be an expose about pesticides. What I'm trying to talk about, and the myth that I'm talking about, is what people did with the book. So it's not even really anything that Rachel Carson had to do with, because she never herself said that she started the environmental movement. It was other people that did that. Even when she was alive, they were doing that, and she just kind of let that go. But she never claimed that herself. So what I'm doing is talking about a story that people have made about where American environmentalism came from by using her book, right? Coming up with this, what I call the Big Book origin story. And so that's the myth. The book itself isn't the myth.
Well, yeah. What do you think encouraged that story, and why has it become so persistent?
Well, it's easy for one. I mean, this is a common way for many people to explain the origins of social movements, not just environmentalism. There are other versions of this sort of Big Book origin stories. And as I begin the Myth of Silent Spring, you know, I talk about how people compared her book to Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? Mm-hmm. Which at the time, some people were saying started the Civil War, which is just absurd, right? I mean, there are so many other ways in which the abolitionist movement and all kinds of other social forces were coming into play that led the nation to the Civil War. And by the time that Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, I mean, you know, the nation's sort of on the eve of that conflict happening. It wasn't like, you know, that this was the media provocation. And so, I mean, that's a good example, and it's actually instructive that's the book that they compared that they compared Silent Spring to when people were talking to Rachel Carson at, you know, in congressional testimony hearings and things like that.
William Douglas too, right? Wasn't it the Supreme Court Justice?
Yeah, the Supreme Court Justice. I mean, E.B. White, people that were reviewing her book, in order to praise it, they were saying, you know, that's how important this book was.
So when you get into this revisionist history and to cut down this myth, you pull from your work and from others' works, like you're saying, to offer a more capacious history of environmentalism. You start way back in the first chapter in the colonial era and as well as in the decades around the revolution. And some might immediately object to you using a 20th century word like environmentalism or environmental thought to describe thought and actions of those who lived two or three centuries before that. So how do you define environmentalism, and where do you see it on display in, for instance, the towns and countrysides of New England?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good question, and it's a good point. It's one also that I think comes up when people talk about, you know, in women's history, when they talk about feminism, like, is someone a feminist if they don't call themselves a feminist, or the word itself hadn't been invented? I think there are three problems with the big book origin story of environmentalism that focuses on Fountain Spring. One is it's an error of when the movement happened. So, you know, the book itself, Fountain Spring, was published in 1962. And as you say, like, what I want to do is sort of push us back into the 19th century. And that's because one of the other problems with the Fountain Spring explanation is that it doesn't entirely account for, I think, the why the movement happened. And I argue that it's industrialization and urbanization that comes with industrialization, and that's already going on in various parts of the country by the early 19th century. And so, like, I teach at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and when I first came to teach here in 2002, I was finishing the Save the Land of People book, and I was really excited about, now I can, you know, get into thinking about using New England, in particular the city of Lowell, as an example of how some kind of environmental consciousness or awareness of environmental problems starting to begin, and environmental protests starting to begin at the same time, parallel with people's experience of moving from the countryside and exchanging agricultural labor for industrial labor and living in the city. And that's what I found. I mean, it's like, in fact, when I started to work on that, and I went to the archives, people were telling me, like, what else could you possibly write about Lowell, you know, and industrialization? And because it seemed like everybody had said everything they could, you know, every different field had tried to make something out of it. But no one had really done it, you know, with the perspective of an environmental historian. And so I did that. And then the other thing that I want to do is sort of question how the origin story that focuses on Fountain Spring doesn't necessarily get all that, doesn't include all the historical actors that should be part of the story. And that's sort of the question of who. And so, you know, like, I wanted this book to be accessible to students and to activists, and to try to frame the history that I make, the interpretation that I make from chapter to chapter, with those three points in mind, sort of the when and the why and the who. And the people in the 19th century don't call themselves environmentalists, but they are dealing with environmental problems, water pollution, they're dealing with, eventually by the early 20th century, air pollution, dealing with solid waste that is, you know, around them in cities or in other places where they're living or working. They're getting exposed to hazards on the job. And I'm just, I mean, maybe because they don't use the word, that doesn't, I don't know why we wouldn't just think that that's, I mean, that's what environmentalists do in the 20th century when the word is invented. So, like, the fact that they don't use the word, it's just sort of like, I think in some ways, kind of an academic argument in this case. And then the protests that they're a part of, or the ways in which they react, or the ways in which they organize, then, because it's about environmental problems, I mean, I think, fits in, at least in terms of trying to understand the origins of environmentalism, it fits in terms of the narrative of where environmentalism comes from. If in fact, you know, they're reacting to environmental problems, and it's not sort of suddenly people doing this in 1963, right after the book published, right? Like, I mean, that's just not true. And I think a lot of people know this, but it just, you know, we just haven't really put all of the pieces of the puzzle together until, you know, we really got to this point in the literature where we have enough to draw on, and people sort of realizing, like, how things are connected. But like I said, I mean, Andrew Hurley is like, I mean, he was like really prescient, right? Like, he is already doing that in environmental inequalities. And I think the book, you know, a lot of people loved it, but it didn't really seem to move the field. I mean, I was just sort of waiting and watching to see, you know, how would this change the way people approach it. And we just kept getting book after book that was like, about, you know, the suburbs, or that said the Silent Spring started the movement, or that again did the hagiography of some of the great environmental, you know, leaders. And I mean, it was just like, I can't take another, you know, biography of John Muir. Like, he's just like, I'm, you know, at least one that doesn't talk about like what I do in the first chapter, which is, you know, how the national parks are a problem, like in a problem to understand. And I mean, that was like Ken Burns, you know, his documentary came out, and like, what is the tagline for like America's greatest idea? Like
that idea. Yeah. Yeah.
The subtitle itself is wrong. Yeah. Right. Like, it's just not. So, you know, what I want to do is write a book that could speak back to those, not only the academics that were sort of doing this, but then other people, you know, in other media, newspapers, magazines, documentary film, children's literature, who are absorbing what the story that academics had told, and it still seemed to be sort of the prevailing understanding. I mean, I think that we need to, hopefully what we'll do is not just sort of, you know, have a conversation among ourselves as professional historians, but that this will bubble up into popular consciousness too. Because as I say at the end of the book, I mean, I think the having the Silent Spring origin story for environmentalism hinders us in terms of the kind of environmental activism that we do now. So this matters more than just about trying to correct the record. It's also about, you know, what our historical consciousness is and what that historical consciousness allows us to do as activists in the present and the future.
Yeah, and I really appreciate it also when you talked about Lowell and elsewhere too, in Chicago and places where even the, you know, post-war environmentalism has this kind of romantic shade to it, right? Kind of, and drawing back to Thoreau and everyone in Concord there, you found, you know, Lowell Mill girls who are writing in just the same way at the same time about kind of the divine, you know, investment in nature. So even that, it's not just about, oh, we missed public health or we missed occupational health. It's also, no, we just missed these people.
Yeah, and then just people just didn't pay any attention to them, right? Because they're women and because they're workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they are reading, like, you know, they are reading the transcendental writers, and sometimes there's public lectures, like Emerson comes to Lowell. But they're kind of inventing a working class romanticism, and I don't think they really got credit for that. And what's interesting is they have a real experience with industrialization and urbanization, whereas the transcendentalists have like this imaginary experience. Like, I don't know, you know, for people that have never been to Concord and Lowell, like there's, you know, 18 miles away from each other, maybe down, what, you know, the Concord River starts in Concord and it ends in Lowell at where it meets the Merrimack River. Those are two different like worlds, and the transcendentalists are in one world and the workers, the mill girls, are in the other. And in fact, when we bring teachers to do a professional development workshops on industrialization, we take them to Concord and we bring them to Lowell, and we do this, we have them read the transcendentalists and read the mill girls' writings, and it's very interesting to have them compare the two. And you know, I mean, I think it's, well, I mean, there's still a way in which I think you need to sort of think about, well, what is the, how are the mill girls themselves sort of reimagining nature? Because it's not necessarily like the nature writing they're doing is necessarily like very, you know, it's a poetic, it's romantic too, but it's still worthwhile. And then later, you know, what we do when we do the workshop is we talk about how the experience that people like the workers are having leads to Massachusetts being a pioneer in terms of water pollution control. They're the first state to have a state board of health, and that's led by a very radical Henry Ingersoll Bowditch. And he articulates an argument that people should have the right to have a right to be healthy and not have to deal with water pollution, and basing it on this, the natural rights sort of tradition that comes from the revolution. And then the state passed the water pollution control law in 1878. But it made three exceptions that are interesting: the Merrimack River, the Connecticut River, and the part of the Concord that went through Lowell as it goes under the Long Street Bridge. So, you know, I mean, there's a story there, and that's, you know, part of what I'm trying to do when I go back into the 19th century and talk about the origins of environmentalism in New England, much earlier than 1962. But it's definitely, it's not a linear narrative.
And later in the chapter, you as you said earlier, you go on to talk about conservation at the federal level and state level, forest and wildlife resources and things like that. And you point out, as others have, that there are victims to these projects. They weren't necessarily the best idea America's had, but I think you even go beyond this to propose that those victims had their own ethic that is worthy of being termed environmental, and they practiced, you know, this moral ecology. Can you talk about that a bit for us?
Well, that I cannot take credit for that. That is from Crimes Against Nature, which is a book I love.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I mean, as I said, I'm this book, The Myth of Silent Spring, is based on my own research, but it's also based on a lot of other good work that people are doing, including that book. And so common people, you know, they have their own ways of engaging nature, maybe not always following all the ecological principles that we figure out later in the 20th or 21st century. But when the first preservation and conservation efforts, kind of begin to find their way into state law or federal law or policy, at least that can be imposed on them, and really without thinking about them or asking, you know, them to be part of sort of creating different engagement, different relationship with nature, and usually in the interest of elite. So, you know, like the first fish commissions don't try to protect fish or set up fish hatcheries so that people have more of the fish that they want to fish for because they want to eat them. They create fish hatcheries to raise fish that gentlemen sportsmen want, right? When they go up to the Adirondacks or go somewhere around New England and want to go trout fishing. That's an ongoing thing through the 20th century. And it's part of the explanation for, to some extent, the resistance of common, ordinary working class people to environmental regulations when that does appear, when it does get manifested. There's a legacy still today in New England and other parts of the country of people being opposed, but not necessarily being willing to be open-minded about environmental regulations because of that long 150 years of things like this happening before. And it not being a democratic process, right? And so that's, I think we need to sort of like undo the way that we sort of crowned, you know, people like John Muir and not really approaching all of that with a critical perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And you go on in the next chapter to survey the Progressive Era and New Deal in the North. And here I think you really start to make obvious that the problems with our dominant narrative of environmentalism are not just that it doesn't start early enough or include all the people it should, but that it really defines environmental problems too narrowly themselves. And so how are progressives and radicals in this chapter you're talking about in the early 20th century conceiving of both the problems, the environmental problems as they see them, and also the causes for them differently than other folks?
Yeah, and I think that was also true in New England among the people like Henry Ingersoll Bowditch. Bowditch was a radical who was, you know, he believed that the problem were corporations. And then when as he pushed that, trying to say that corporations shouldn't be able to dump stuff into the rivers that were making people sick, then they managed to get the governor they actually merged the Board of Health with the Board of Lunacy. And so then that basically took him out of the ability to sort of orchestrate trying to expand state responsibility for controlling pollution. But into the 20th century, the people that are involved in dealing with environmental problems, whether it's in the community, in the neighborhoods, or in the workplace, they often have, at the same time, a pretty good understanding of how that's tied to their economic exploitation, how it's tied to economic inequality, that environmental problems aren't contained, they're not just environmental problems, that they're connected, and that these are also part of, it would be like you said at the beginning, you know, they don't call themselves environmentalists. Like, I often wanted to try to go back and like ask some of these people, like, did you think of these as environmental problems or like as labor problems? Like, did they think of them distinctly, or did they think of environmental problems as labor problems, you know, or did they think of them as community problems? Which would maybe be an argument against saying that they're environmentalists, but it also would be an argument against this idea that you can study environmental problems and what people do about them with his blinder on, saying they have to be calling them environmental in order for it to be part of the story, right? Like, that's a problem. That isn't going to give you a very good understanding of what was going on in the past, right? To approach it that way. And then race and ethnicity are part of that too, as Colin Fisher points out in his book, Urban Green. And I talk about sort of some of what he covers in his book in that second chapter, the people that are themselves, like moving to Chicago, becoming industrial workers, they also want to have some kind of, you know, respite from their work, or they want to get out of their neighborhoods that are dirty and hot. And they go to the lake, they go to parks, they go to even state forest reserves. They do it as members of particular communities, as workers, because their union has a place to go, or they do it as African-Americans. They go to a place where they don't have to deal with, you know, white racism. And I love that about his book too, like the way in which he says, you know, you can't disentangle this. Like, this is how people understood their experience with nature.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you end that chapter at, of all places, a summer camp in Port Huron, Michigan, where several of your threads kind of come together. Could you tell us a little about that place and suggest how the history of environmentalism looks different, for instance, if we look out from Port Huron?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I decided to write my second book, Making a Living, because my grandfather was a member of the United Auto Workers. He worked at Dana Auto Parts in Toledo, Ohio. And so all the kids in the family, my father included, went to Sand Lake, which was a camp run by the United Auto Workers, a summer camp. They also had a summer camp program at Port Huron. The Port Huron, like, space was open not just to kids, but that was one thing to do with it. It was also meant for people to be able to come, you know, from the union and have meetings there. And then when students at the University of Michigan and Wisconsin and other universities decided to have the founding meeting for the students for Democratic Society in 1962, because some of those people actually also had family members who were part of the UAW, that's how they got to use the Port Huron camp to write the Port Huron Statement, what became known as the Port Huron Statement. So, you know, in that place, which the UAW had sort of intended for, you know, people to go out and experience sort of nature, in a way, they're bringing kids, like people in my family, to also learn about how to be members of a democratic society. Like, so the kids, you know, the program that they have are, you know, you can go horseback riding, or you go to the beach, or you go on hikes, but you also learn about how to, you know, be like effective members of a democracy, you know, teaching them various principles about, you know, equality and why labor unions were important, things like how to write, how to be a public speaker. And so that wasn't like, you didn't just go out and escape from society. Mm-hmm. In fact, you went out there in order to become more effective member of society. And then when the college students went and did that, that wasn't like an odd thing, right? That was already something they'd been doing at the summer camp for a few years. So that camp is an important part of the vision of Walter Reuther and Olga Mattar and other people that were part of the United Auto Workers leadership, because they had this idea that the UAW would not only represent their work, their membership in terms of their, you know, interest in trying to raise wages or reduce hours or improve working conditions, but also in terms of, a social unionism that made the union, an important part of trying to deal with racial inequality and fighting, helping people who are fighting against segregation and trying to get blacks the right to vote again in the South. And even including also environmental issues. Walter Reuther was very much an advocate for trying to use the infrastructure and resources of the UAW to deal with water pollution as well as air pollution. And ironically, for many people, right, the UAW was sort of among the most important of institutions in terms of trying to get state as well as federal legislation to control pollution, both water pollution and air pollution. And that's actually true in a lot of other cases. The unions, you would think, supposedly wouldn't be environmentally minded because we have this idea that, you know, that the ones that represent members that do things or make things that are the most harmful to environment would be the least likely. It's the UAW, it's the United Mine Workers, it's the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, those unions, the United Steel Workers, they're the ones who are the pioneers in terms of labor environmentalism. And in many ways, you could argue, I do in the book, that in fact, they're pioneering environmentalism, you know, as a movement, like that it's labor unions and workers and their leadership that are the earliest to voice concerns and to do things to try to bring about some kind of regulatory redress of the problems that they're facing.
Yeah, yeah. And then that really, you go on to explore that more in the third chapter where you look at the post-war environmental movement, which we often, you know, it's common to think of this as that mainstream environmentalism after World War II as being at odds with both the Black freedom struggle and the labor movement, or at least in tension with them. But you argue pretty powerfully. I mean, certainly the whole narrative you're sketching does this, but in that chapter too, that really that's the view from the other side of the Reagan Revolution, basically, that we kind of see this idea that workers, working people, poor people must choose between jobs and a clean environment, as something that's, you know, as an ideology that was constructed, or an argument that's constructed by Reagan era conservatives and sort of became sort of seen as fact. But I should say there were tensions, right? There were absolutely tensions within those activist groups. So maybe could you help us kind of maybe take a couple of these and help us see kind of where those alliances were strongest, and maybe where also there were some tensions that ended up kind of being exploited.
Well, I think this is one of the ways in which I do. In which I am a critic of Silent Spring. Book is supposed to be an expose of pesticides, but there are only a few lines that talk about farm workers. When Rachel Carson does talk about farm workers, it's usually part of like a sentence that she's talking about, you know, people that are spraying pesticides from planes and field hands and farmers or something like that. Or she'll talk about, you know, I think in one case she talked about some farm workers who were exposed to a particular pesticide in an orange grove, and that's all. You'd think, I mean, they should actually be at the center of that book. They should dominate that book, and they don't. And it's because she just wasn't thinking in terms of class and race. She was thinking about, you know, these harmful pesticides. We need to do something about them. There are other options, but she wasn't thinking about, well, how come they could be used? How come people like farm workers, you know, are out there using them? What kind of power do growers have that they can make
right.
that people actually have to apply them? And then, unfortunately, she didn't mean to do this, but there's some evidence that the criticism that she leveled at the pesticide industry had made some growers switch from pesticides that were less persistent, so that they wouldn't end up, you know, on produce when they made it to the grocery, and to you know it'd be safer for consumers. And then if the government agency was sort of trying to monitor that they would see that there was less pesticide on the product. But that are actually those pesticides that they switched to are more acute in terms of initial application. So that made farm workers sicker, right? And so that just was, you know, again, not something that she intended to do. But the story of farm workers is left out of Silent Spring. And then the way in which we think about the origin story is one that there have been some really good articles and books about the farm workers by environmentalists, but we haven't really, I think, fully incorporated or reckoned with what it would mean to bring them into the origin story, right, and to talk about how they're part of the rise environmental movement. And one of the things that we'd have to confront if we did is that environmental groups actually weren't always very open to working with the United Farm Workers, right? The UFW had to struggle to get anybody from the mainstream environmental groups to help them. That was not true, of course, of other labor unions who saw that what they were doing was something that you know, they were their allies. And there are other cases like that where environmental groups like the Sierra Club or the Environmental Defense Fund or the Environmental Policy Center, that they actually undermine and very intentionally undermine grassroots activism that's going on, like the movement against strip mining in Appalachia. The people that were doing that in Kentucky, West Virginia, and in other states in southern Appalachia were arguing by the late 60s and early 70s for a ban on strip mining. And they were getting close to getting enough signatures on a bill to do that at the federal level in the very early 1970s. And the Sierra Club representative who was sort of in charge of dealing with that in Congress, and Louise Dunlap was part of the EPC, they were colluding behind the scenes to tell members of Congress, you don't really need to ban this. We will work out a compromise. And that then made it very difficult for the grassroots activists to continue to push the abolition bill forward. And as a result, in 1977, the bill that Congress finally passed was really devastating for the coal fields of Appalachia, for the people living there, because it basically legalized the destruction of the region, and it allows for mountaintop removal, which is now the new way of strip mining that's really just horrendous. That's partly, it's not only because of the mainstream environmental groups, but they play a role in making that happen by making it harder for the grassroots activists to continue to push their agenda forward. And they did it because they were like career environmentalists, and they had their own interest in mind, along with industry, along with other things that were going on. But these are the stories I think that we need to be remembering in order to understand why we're in the place we're in the 1990s or the 21st century, with workers environmentalists seemingly at different, at odds, and companies and corporations being able to divide them by this rhetoric of jobs versus the environment. Like that doesn't work because it's inherently logical. It works because there's a history of, it's an intended also, because of a history of labor environmentalism that to some extent was thwarted by environmentalists themselves not being really good allies for labor. People always say, well, why don't workers come, and understand environmental problems are really important and they should, come along and be on board. Well, it can work the other way around, right? Why don't environmentalists create the conditions in which it's easier for workers to do that, right? As it was in the 1950s, 60s, and some parts of the 1970s. In Appalachia, for instance, we need a just transition bill. If you want, people who are mine workers to easily sort of move from being coal miners to something else, then, we create a federal program in which they get retrained to make wind turbine blades or something mm-hmm. like that, right? And they're members of the United Mine Workers becomes a wind turbine labor union instead of a coal mine workers union. I mean, coal is going away anyway. So the fact that environmentalists aren't pushing that harder is in some extent sort of telling about how they themselves have sort of their own blinders and need to think about what this history might mean for the way that they refocus the movement.
I wonder if you noticed over your career teaching that the students that come into your classes has their kind of environmental consciousness been changing, and do you feel like they are as kind of swept up in this kind of mythic thinking about a kind of limited scope of environmental problems and an unnuanced understanding of the causes of them as ever, or do you think that it's changing at all?
It's not changing much. When I teach an environmental history course, they've absorbed a lot of this. It's interesting, right? Like a lot of people know these myths somehow. And there are a lot of children's books that say Rachel Carson's Silent Spring started the movement. So, the things like that people hear this and they walk into the classroom with it. And it's hard to undo those myths because they're easier, right? Like when I start talking, as I've been talking for an hour, like this is too complicated, right? Like people would rather not. I mean, my friends joke that I should have a YouTube channel called Chad Ruins History because and they start talking, don't tell us the story, the real story. Just we want to believe, the myth and because it's so much easier. But my students are all very interested in climate change. They know that this is could be the end of their the world as they know it for them and their generation. And after the election in November of 2016, the next couple of days I had students in my classes who were in tears and some of them, they were upset about what this would mean in terms of the progress that they thought they were beginning to make in terms of a movement to deal with climate change and how this is going to set them back, including with Pruitt being put in charge of the EPA, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. We'll see. And, it'll be interesting. I'm interested as an historian, like I said, how the field's going to evolve. Cause I think there's some, like I said, there's really great people working on things like Colin and Carl, people that, Elizabeth Blum. But I'm not sure that, I just feel like that there's a way in which the field sort of just politely has ignored us. Continued on, and we still get the same story. That's very different from other fields that I have some knowledge about. Like when I was in graduate school, I did a minor field in women's history, and I felt like they were constantly, like historians are a part of that field, constantly arguing with one another and evolving and changing the field, right? And I just don't see that happening with environmental history as a field. Like, I mean, I think it probably is to some extent with some particular issues, like bison on the plains or something, but. But in a general way, I don't know if we really are, if we evolve as fast, if our debates are sort of, if they're even happening as fervently, and if they're moving people to sort of change their interpretations.
Yeah. Well, Before we say goodbye, you teased your upcoming, your next book project already. Can you tell us more about that? We'd love to hear.
Yeah, so except it's not environmental history. So, I mean, that's like I said. I've always been interested in how race matters in American life. And so growing up in Kentucky, I had a sense of, how race works in the South. And, as an historian, I've read a lot about, race in American history and the civil rights movement. But I'm very interested in this idea of how race matters in the North. And because a lot of times I think people sort of think of racism and segregation as a Southern phenomenon. And so what I decided to do is write a book about racial exclusion in Minnesota, looking at the history of racial exclusion from the 19th to the 20th century, there as how whites keep African Americans out of their communities, their neighborhoods, their suburbs, even whole towns. And doing it in Minnesota because, of course, many people think, actually when I tell people that I'm writing this book, they say, well, why Minnesota? And that's actually why I'm writing it, because that's often the question people ask, right? Because you think of it as so far north, therefore it's sort of away from the geographic center of racial problems in America. And it has a reputation of being somewhat progressive. Like, it's the place where Hubert Humphrey comes from. It's the place where Walter Mondale comes from. But when you look at its history, it's very similar to other parts of the country. And so what I'm trying to do is talk about race as a thing that matters for us in terms of a national sort of like the American identity and a national narrative, and not just a regional narrative. Something that maybe there's racism in the North, but it's certainly very different from the South. And actually what I'm sort of finding is that it's not so different. It maybe has different variations in the way that it gets manifested, but that there's a common story for us as Americans.
That's fascinating. I really appreciate that. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, Chad, and I hope everyone goes out and gets The Myth of Silent Spring and is on the lookout for the next one.
Okay, thank you, Brian.